You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today teaches one of the most popular courses at Yale University School of Management, titled Mastering Influence and Persuasion. But students often call it doing uncomfortable things that make you a better person. When we talk about influence and persuasion, it's a tricky thing. Most of us would like to be an influencer, but when we are asked to think how influencers use their influence, we often think of manipulative or coercive techniques. That's because we think of influence as power. Zoe Chance has a completely different paradigm, and it's one of empowerment for yourself, for your peers, coworkers, and colleagues. Chance's book, Influence is Your Superpower, The Science of Winning Hearts, Sparking Change, and Making Good Things Happen, utilizes behavioral science to help us get our ideas across, how to lead work groups, and empower everyone along the way. The book turns a lot of what we think we know about persuasion and influence on its head. Zoe Chance is an assistant professor of marketing at the Yale School of Management, and her research has been published in top academic journals and then reported on in major journalism centers from the New York Times to The Economist. She's consulted with major companies and once managed the Barbie brand at Mattel before turning to work in academia. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Chance, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Great to meet you, Rich.
Yeah. One of the goals of your book, In Influence is Your Superpower, is, as you say, to unlock our tumul. I hope I'm saying that right. It's a Mongolian term. But so what is tumul, and why is it central to the point you're trying to get across in this book?
I hope you're saying it right. That's how I say it. I did have a Mongolian friend help me practice it, and it was hard. Tumul is described as the look in the eye of a horse that is racing in the direction it wants to go, regardless of what its rider wants. And it's a word that describes creative passion. And it's that feeling that you have when you know what you want. And I write about this early on in my book because this is one of the first big obstacles to even practicing any of the influence techniques that I teach, because so many of us aren't quite sure yet what we want, or maybe we think we know, and then we get it, or we start to get it, and we find out that we didn't have that feeling of satisfaction and joy that we had expected.
You know, one of the things you do write about very early is the fact that when we're children, we're born influential, that, you know, because we need others to thrive, and actually our maturation is a very long period compared to most species, we need people to help nurture us and take care of us for many years. But that natural tendency gets suppressed by societal norms and expectations. How do we recapture that? I mean, that's a hard thing to do. It's going against this long grain that's going one way and you're going the other way.
Yeah, it's a deep and heavy burden that our parents and our teachers set on our shoulders when they tell us to play nice and train us to be good students. What they're asking us to do is not take up too much space in the world. They want us to stop asking for what we want. They want us to get what we deserve by working hard and waiting to be recognized. But that's not how success works once we get out of school. There's no teacher waiting to grade us and give us a gold star. So we've been steered awry in this way. And most of us don't ever leave those tendencies behind. Most of us are people pleasers. And I've learned this because I've had a chance over the last decade to read hundreds of private journals that students keep in my class, which is called Mastering Influence and Persuasion. It's the most popular class at Yale School of Management. And they reflect on their influence experiences and their feelings and their thoughts about those. It is so uncomfortable to ask, and it is so uncomfortable to say no, and it is so uncomfortable to get rejected that students have actually nicknamed my course Doing Uncomfortable Things That Make You a Better Person. What we gain through that practice, and those are simple ones, and you know, of course, I teach a bunch of science and strategies along with it, what we gain is the confidence and the resilience to be able to step up and be more audacious, dream bigger, and follow that tamul feeling of passionate desire to actually trying to get those things that we wish for instead of just wishing that they would happen.
You know, one of the things that comes up time and time again is there's this sort of dichotomy that we're taught simultaneously to be helpful to others, if we at all possible, to stop doing what you're doing and help someone else who comes to you with a problem. At the same time, we're taught to be self-reliant, to not ask for help from others. That seems like just a conflict, you know, that's at loggerheads.
It's absolutely a conflict. It's a double bind. And it's true for all of us. And it's especially true for women in at least my generation, Gen X and Y and Z, where we've had from our feminist foremothers a lot of emphasis on self-reliance. But yeah, we end up just depleted, exhausted, being helpful, but not so much helped because we haven't asked. And there's no possible way that we can thrive and succeed in the long run in that sweet, depleted state. So we need to advocate for ourselves and we need to be able to take care of our own needs if we have a desire to be helpful for other people.
Well, you describe this book as sort of the low-hanging fruit of influence and being able to influence others. You begin the book by explaining basic cognition theory. System one is the instinctual snap judgment perceiving style that we inevitably use. In fact, we use it probably 90% of the time or more. And system two is the rational analytical style where we stop to think over a situation or something we see and spend some time analyzing what you're seeing. And you call that the gator and the judge. Why those names and how do they help us understand these processes and better utilize them?
I chose these names after teaching behavioral economics for a while to executives and discovering that system one and system two just aren't very sticky. It's really easy to mix up which are which. And it wasn't until after I started teaching that I admitted to myself, actually, when I was a PhD student, I was mixing up which one is system one and which one is system two. So I just picked an analogy that would be easy to remember. And the gator is the primal decision-making system, and it's unconscious, like it's lurking below the surface of the water, below the surface of your conscious mind. And the judge is this conscious, slow, rational, deliberate, effortful system that seems to be rational and it seems to be objective, just like a judge. It tries, but ultimately it's influenced a great deal by system one, the gator.
You know, you use the term the gator, and really it's sort of instinctual because really it's our reptilian brain. When you talk to brain researchers, they refer to that part of our brain is the one that says, okay, flight or fight, threat or opportunity.
And honestly, like that when behavioral economists talk about these two systems, we're not making a direct map to anatomy. It's really an analogy. And if there are neuroscientists listening, it's a little bit complicated because the parts of the brain that are called the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain, which governs the emotions, I'm talking about both of those parts together when I say the gator. And then you wonder like, oh, gators aren't very nice. But I could talk about actual alligators all day. So I'm going to try to close my nerdy mouth and pause here.
One of the things you say is really important is ease. When a decision, process, or procedure is easy, almost everyone will have a positive reaction. It's a great way to gain influence. Even a complaint, if the process to make that complaint is easy and some result is taken at the end, people come away with a positive feeling 90-something percent of the time. Why is ease so important?
Ease really is the bedrock principle of influence. And we think it also is related to a big misunderstanding about influence, where we imagine that we need to change people's minds. And people considering buying my book are thinking that I'm going to teach them how to change people's minds. And I have some suggestions for making baby steps in that direction. But ultimately, what we're usually trying to do is influence someone's behavior. First of all, that doesn't always or maybe even often require changing their mind. And second of all, it's incredibly difficult, incredibly rare, and takes a very long time to change people's minds. So if what we want to do is influence their behavior, then we should be taking the direct route and doing something behavioral rather than hoping that we change the mind and the mind influences the behavior. Rich, I don't know if you ever make New Year's resolutions. Did you make any this year?
I made one and it lasted about 2 weeks.
Okay, just like the rest of us. And so that's an illustration. Can I ask what it, or was it too personal if I ask you what it was?
I was going to look at some core strengthening.
Okay, so you wanted to do more exercise. I do wanted to do more exercise, and I haven't done it because it's not easy. And that's the reason that I wasn't doing it before. So, and there are things you and I and everyone else can do to make it a little bit easier. But generally, when somebody is open-minded, whether it's you or another person, when you're open to the possibility of doing this thing, then the best thing you can do is make it as easy as possible because people take the path of least resistance. Can I nerd out for a second?
Yep.
About alligators again?
Yep. I knew
this,
you were going
this
there.
Is a key reason that I picked the analogy of an alligator because they are so darn lazy. And I learned this when I went to Gatorland in Orlando, Florida. And it's the alligator capital of the world. They have 3,000 alligators. And one of the things you can do besides fly over them on a zip line in a gator infested swamp, you can watch gator wrestling, you can feed the alligators and you feed them chunks of meat. So I thought they're just going to clash and fight like monsters. But no, I don't have perfect aim. And so I throw a piece of meat that's near the gators. And what happens is nothing. Nobody moves. They wait until a bird comes down to get it. And I throw some more pieces of meat. Every time I get the meat within what is called the bite zone of the alligator, I'm smiling because I'm getting so nerdy. When you get the meat within the bite zone, the gator snaps it up so quickly, you can hardly see it move. But if it is even a centimeter outside of that narrow band, the gator doesn't move, it just waits. They're so efficient that their brains are the size of a walnut, and they need only about 2 pounds of meat per week. Well, actually, that's their preference. They need way less than that. Alligators can go up to 3 years without food. The analogy is gators ignore almost everything, and we too, like alligators, ignore almost every influence attempt, and we will rarely take action unless it is incredibly easy. I'll share something that happened in my family where so this was with my daughter's dad when we were married, and we kept fighting over this little thing that for some reason he would shower and he would wash his hair and then he would leave the shampoo on the windowsill in the bathroom instead of leaving it in the shower. And I can't tell you, Rich, how many fights we had over this where I was explaining why I cared and trying to motivate him, trying to threaten him, carrots, sticks, reason. None of this was changing his behavior. And then finally, it dawned on me that I could just buy a shampoo dispenser, install it inside the shower. And of course, everything is fine and it's not a problem anymore. So it's a silly example, but this is an analogy for the very different route to influence that we can consider.
My guest today is Zoe Chance, an assistant professor of marketing at the Yale School of Management, where she teaches influence and persuasion. And her new book is titled Influence is Your Superpower, The Science of Winning Hearts, Sparking Change, and Making Good Things Happen. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. And one of the very first things you do in that class is tell your students they have to say no for 24 hours. Learning to say no, you write about an incident where saying no saved the world, but it's always a stressor for us. Why is learning to say no important in building influence when you would think saying no would reduce your influence? It seems counterintuitive.
Yeah, when I assign that challenge, people are horrified. And they really don't want to do it because it's so uncomfortable for us to say no to people. Almost all of us in our secret hearts are people pleasers. We care about people. We don't want to hurt them. We know that rejection can be painful. So we don't want to be the ones causing that pain. But what happens when we practice saying no is that, first of all, by the way, anyone who is listening, I challenge you to say no to everyone who asks you for something in the next 24 hours. It's a dare. So when you practice this, what you find afterward is, first of all, people don't hate you. You didn't die. They were really mostly just asking. They didn't even expect you to say yes much of the time. Second of all, the way that they react to you positively or negatively is not about whether you say yes or no, but about how you treat them as a human being. So you can be warm, you can be funny, you can be perfectly cordial and kind while still saying no. And you find that you have all this power and all of this time that you didn't know that you could have had. And my guess is you may be one of the many people who has an epiphany about how incredibly powerful this is if you would actually let yourself say no instead of passively agreeing to whatever the world throws at you. But then you'll also be angry and sad at how many years it took you to learn this lesson. So this is this first piece. I need to caveat, since I gave you guys all a dare, please don't ruin your life. So if you get a dream job offer or your sweetie proposes marriage, don't be like, no. Take care of yourself. You're the boss of your life. And secondly, if it's one person making multiple requests, you don't need to say no to every single one of them. You can say no to the first one, experience your no saying, experience their reaction, and then you don't have to keep saying no if you don't want to. But the other thing, last number three caveat, is you can change your mind. You and everyone else on earth has the right to change your mind all the time, anytime. So after you've said no, if you regret it, you can sleep on it, or you know right then, you can go back and change your mind. And they will be elated to have you change your no to a yes.
So let's talk about the counterintuitive part. The counterintuitive part would be, okay, I'm going to say no to this person. My influence is going to wane because I'm not being helpful. How does it in fact enhance your influence?
Yeah. The magical piece that comes out of saying no that makes you more influential is this. When you become more comfortable saying no, you become more comfortable with other people saying no. And when you are more comfortable with the possibility that they might reject you, you approach them in a more gentle, friendly, possibly even playful and humorous way, making it easier for them to say no, because they don't have to say yes, there's no pressure. But by making it easier to say no, you're making them more inclined to say yes. Hmm.
Another great discovery that you had was when a restaurateur came to Yale and came to you, to your professors and teachers, and said, guess what? You're not in the education business. You're in the hospitality industry. How did that change the way you teach your class and how you go about doing your own work?
I was so inspired that day by Danny Meyer, is this restaurateur who changed my life. And really, he was telling the MBA students, I thought, listen, you're not in whatever business you think you're in. You're in the hospitality business. And I at first thought that message wasn't for me because I am in the education business. Obviously, I'm a teacher. I'm not even in business. I just teach. But then when I asked myself what it might look like, what my job might be, what I might do differently if I reframed my work as being a host instead of a teacher, my teaching became so pleasurable for me and for my students and for my TAs. And it really revolutionized what class was like. So I was already a star teacher. I had a background in theater, and I put my heart and soul and every waking moment into putting on a great show in class, shining in the spotlight. But I was so rigid about what had to be in place for that to happen that you can imagine what the rest of the situation was like if what I really wanted to do and actually tried to let happen was to lock the doors to the classroom the second that I started teaching so that nobody could come in late and disturb the show and ruin it for the rest of the audience. So this is, you know, it's a show, but it was all about me, the teacher. And when I shifted my perspective to what if I'm the host and the students are the guests, I was shifting my attention from me to them, and then it's all about them. And I'm not trying to get them to do things and judging and evaluating how good or bad or smart or dumb they are. Of course, I have to give grades, but I did things like I stopped taking attendance, not just stopped grading attendance, but I stopped taking attendance because if you're hosting a party, you can't require anyone to be there. The TAs and I show up early, we play music, we greet people, welcoming them, smiling, calling them by name. And the students don't have to be perfect. If you're a guest, you can spill wine on the carpet and it's okay. And as a teacher, I don't have to be perfect either. I can have cat hair on the sofa or burn the casserole and my guests are still gonna love me. Since I stopped taking attendance, the number of students who still come to class on any given day is 95% of all the ones who are registered. I'm sharing this partly to bring into your mind, listeners, the possibility of how engaged your employees might continue to be if you fulfilled their wish to be virtual when they wanted or to have more space, if you didn't require them to be there.
Yeah. And it also gets into another part of your book, which talks about charisma, the very idea that by changing the focus from me being charismatic to me looking at you and focusing on you and hearing your story, that paradoxically actually increases your charisma, is what research studies have told us, right?
Yeah, it's incredible. When you ask people, what does it mean to be charismatic? And they tell you, well, people pay attention to you. But it's not like, running through the office in your underwear is going to be charismatic, right? Although people pay attention to you. Really what charisma is listening. It's listening and paying close attention to another person. That's what gives them the feeling of being the only person in the room. It's how people describe highly charismatic individuals like presidents are often described this way, right? It's all about your attentional focus. And when you, all of us, want to practice shifting our focus to the other person, two super easy things we can do are just practice using people's names more often, because we're not only getting their attention, it activates a specific part of the brain when we say their name, and you know that it can bring you out of even a deep slumber, or you notice it in a loud party when someone says your name. It does get their attention, but it also reminds you that this conversation is about that person. It's not about me. And the second thing that you can do is you can just ask more questions. So instead of making a statement and sharing your idea, you might ask them what they think about that topic, or you might ask just very simple shift. What do you think of this crazy idea? And that's a much better conversation than just, here's a crazy idea.
Or I have this idea.
Or I had this idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I do want to ask about the magic question. This is something you talk about in the book quite a bit. What is the magic question?
This is my very favorite influence strategy that I teach because it is so easy. So everyone listening, you can put it into action today. The magic question is just, what would it take? And I'll tell a brief story so that you can get a concrete idea of the kinds of things that are possible. And this was a story that Gloria Steinem told when she came to my hometown of New Haven. She was working on the problem of sex trafficking. And she had gone to this village in rural Zambia where three young women had left the village, lost to sex traffickers the previous year, and nobody had heard from them again. And Gloria Steinem is sitting down on a tarp in the middle of a field in a circle group of women, and she asks these women the magic question. She says, what would it take to prevent that from ever happening again, for no young women to be lost to sex trafficking from this village? And they told her, an electric fence. An electric fence? They said, when the corn reaches a certain height, the elephants come and they eat the corn, they trample the crops. We have no food. We have nothing to sell in the market, and we have no money to send our kids to school. These women and their families were desperate. Gloria Steinem goes back home. She raises a few thousand dollars, sends it to them, And the way she tells the story, she comes back a few years later, there's a bumper crop of corn, and no young women have been sex trafficked from that village since they got the fence. So the magic question is, what would it take? And I'll tell you why. Some of it you're figuring out already, and at least one part is not obvious. The first piece is that it's respectful. And because it's respectful, you can use it in almost any situation, and almost any person will respond kindly to it or comfortably to it, because you're saying, I acknowledge that you are the expert. You know the situation. You know the obstacles. I don't know. Gloria Steinem never could have figured out that what they needed was an electric fence, right? It's also magic because as you are shifting their mindset from resistance to influence to collaborative problem solving, they are generating ideas that often you never would have thought of, like the electric fence. The third, maybe most important piece that's least obvious is that when they tell you what it would take, they are implicitly committing to supporting your goal. The way I interpret the story of the electric fence is that it's not just the electric fence that prevents sex trafficking. It's the women who asked for the electric fence that prevent sex trafficking when they got what they asked for. So the magic question is, what would it take? I hope that that story isn't deeply personally relatable for people from your own life, but we empathetically it is, right? But we can use the magic question with our kids. You wanna figure out how, like, what is it going to take for them to get their room clean? You can ask this question of employees or partners. Someone, instead of criticizing them, you can ask, what would it take to change that behavior? And you could just ask, you can ask this question about big, big issues, like, what would it take to get a policy changed in our company? Or what would it take to get a policy changed in our country? I had a director from the New York Times in my class a couple of years ago, and she went back to the New York Times and she asked repeatedly for a year, what would it take to get egg or sperm freezing covered for all employees who wanted it as a benefit? And after 1 year, they finally said yes. And the New York Times is the only media company to offer that to their employees. Mm.
It's a powerful question, and there's lots of good advice in this book, backed by science. It's titled Influence is Your Superpower. Zoe, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
It was such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you, Rich.
Zoe Chance is an assistant professor of marketing at the Yale School of Management, where she teaches influence and persuasion. Her new book is titled Influence is Your Superpower, The Science of Winning Hearts, Sparking Change, and Making Good Things Happen. It's published by Random House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.